the station of the nations, AM 1270, WHLD, Niagara Falls, Buffalo, New York, a Citadel Broadcasting Communications Station.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 3:15, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
It's Monday, October 25th, 2004, and welcome to today's show. This is Dr. Rob Stahl with What Should You Expect at Your Age? What you should expect at your age is a lot. And my listeners, especially the older adults and caregivers out there, shouldn't settle for less. Last week we talked about living options for seniors, part one, with Bob Meese of Beechwood Continuing Care and Mike Maloney of Niagara Lutheran Health System. Today's show, we'll talk about safety. How you can make sure you're doing everything you can to protect yourself from accidents. Accidents that in younger adults would be innocuous, but in older adults could result in a tragedy. I have with me today Patty Ann Gazinski, who is a volunteer with the Erie County Department of Emergency Services, and Kitty Sullivan, a representative for Lifeline Systems. The phone number for your calls is 855-6848. And we're all here to answer your questions. Welcome, ladies. I'm glad you could be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about your backgrounds and your current responsibilities? They're trying to decide who's going to go first, and we'll start with Kitty.
I'll be happy to do that, Dr. Stahl. I have spent a lot of time working in community centers, specifically working with seniors and in and around the city of Buffalo. So that has always been a job for me where I was developing programs and doing a lot of communicating and promoting. At present, I'm with the Lifeline Systems through the Visiting Nursing Association here based in Buffalo. And my job is to be out telling people about the Lifeline service.
Okay, thanks. And you, Patty Ann?
I'm a volunteer with the Erie County Department of Emergency Services and write hazard mitigation plans and flood plans and have an interest in senior safety because my grandmother died from a fall when I was a teenager. So that's been my interest.
Now, you've also done a lot of things related to public safety. Why don't you mention a few of those things as well?
I'm a nurse, an EMT, been a professional firefighter.
And when did you start your professional firefighting?
1975.
Okay, and so as far as personal experiences, you mentioned one. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
About my grandmother's accident?
Yes, yes.
I was 16 and was her sole caregiver at the time, and she needed to go to the bathroom one evening, and I didn't know how to transfer anybody properly at that time, and as I was helping her get up from the bedroom, she fell and hit her head on the edge of the dresser and died of a concussion 2 weeks later. So for a 16-year-old, that's pretty devastating.
Mm-hmm.
To lose the most important person in your life.
And she had bleeding inside her head,
yes,
probably.
She did. Yeah. She did. She also had leukemia. So it was just very hard for me to take at 16, and that sort of remained with me. And so in her honor, I've always been interested in seniors and keeping them safe.
Kitty, have you had any personal experiences?
Well, I'll probably be dating myself, but my first job in a community center was during the blizzard of 77, so I'm taking myself back a little ways. At that time, as you may recall, there was a driving ban, so the community center where I was posted was a drop-off point for Meals on Wheels. We were delivering medication, and we were working very closely with the police department and the fire department. Unfortunately, in the process of delivering medications and meals to people, I found a lot of people down and deceased. And, you know, that really stayed with me. As you said, Patty, it was quite traumatic. And it occurred to me that there has to be a way for people to be able to get help and not to be so isolated.
So you went out and you found people that had died?
People deceased, yeah, absolutely. Where we were trying to get their medication to them in a timely fashion. And I think I learned a lot about how many people are out there by themselves, not necessarily having much of a support system, and the need to be connected and to be safe in their homes.
So, and that's safety in the sense of a regional disaster, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And Patty Ann, have you dealt with disaster-type safety issues?
Yes, when we were writing the county's mitigation plan for all of the hazards, we took into account special populations and looked at what the seniors in the area would need and made provisions in the plan for that, working with the local disaster coordinators.
Interesting. Now, what I want to do is we'll go through during the show talking about different aspects of safety with the goal to try and give some very practical tips to people that they can use and hopefully prevent an accident that could be result in a tragedy, really. Now, why don't you briefly talk about your organizations, and Patty Ann, we could start with the Erie County Department of Emergency Services. Just give us an overview of what that agency does and how it particularly focuses on safety for senior citizens.
The Erie County Department of Emergency Services is charged with emergency planning, response, safety of people in the county. People can call the Department of Emergency Services for literature, ask questions, get on the website and see what we can do for them.
Do you have that phone number? We can give that phone number right now.
858-6578. And if you call that number, we can tell you who your local community disaster coordinator is. And if you have any questions, we can lead you to them. For example, they could come out to a senior citizens group and talk about fire safety, home safety, winter driving tips, all of those items.
And the website?
Is www.erie.gov.
So it's the main Erie County website, and then you look for emergency services within that. And you, Kitty, Lifeline Systems, it's a pretty well-known name. Mm-hmm. And just coming down here, I heard an ad on the radio for another presumably similar type of effort. I believe it was Life Alarm System. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Lifeline Systems and what the scope of that company is, and maybe a little bit about what other companies and efforts there are out there to address safety.
Sure. Well, as you may already know, Lifeline is a North American company, so there are Lifeline programs across the United States and in Canada as well. Lifeline has been providing emergency response services for 30 years. This year is their 30th anniversary. The company, which is based in Framingham, Massachusetts, was started by a gerontologist who 30 years ago was looking for a way to enable people to remain in their homes safely and came up with a system that allowed people to press a button when they need help. And it is what it is really designed to help people remain in their homes safely, and there are other providers of emergency response. But the idea behind it is that if you need help, if you're an individual, and not, I think we tend to think of an older person as being perhaps the most needy, but it really is designed for anybody of any age who has a medical condition that makes them a little bit more at risk, or maybe they live alone and don't have much of a support system. It is a way for them to signal for help, because you want to get help quickly, but you also want to get the appropriate help.
So we're all familiar, many of us are familiar with the wristband that you can press.
Right.
And I believe there are things that can hang like a pendant around your neck. Mm-hmm. What else does the basic Lifeline system look like?
Well, there's actually two pieces of equipment involved with Lifeline. As you say, you do have the choice of wearing a button like a wrist strap, or you can wear it like a necklace. And the buttons are small, they're lightweight, they're attractive, but probably most importantly, they're completely waterproof. So they really are designed to be worn in the bath and in the shower. They can get wet and go under the water, and the system still functions. It works with another piece of equipment that we call a communicator. It's a small box that literally your phone plugs into. When we do an installation, what we're actually doing is programming your button to work with your communicator. When you press your button, that's how you activate the system. Your button sends a signal from your button to your communicator, and it can do that from a good distance away, like 400 and 500 feet, because when you need help, you might be in another room or on another floor or in
out
some
in
areas
yard.
It could be out in the yard, and that's a very important concept for Lifeline, is that when we're installing your service, we want to find out a little bit about you. So if you're in your garden from, you know, April till September, we want to be sure that we test it to work that far.
What if you're in your car or just out shopping or out taking a hike in the woods? Is there anything that hooks into cell phones nowadays?
I think that technology is here and being worked on, but at present it only works within the confines of your home.
Interesting. Okay, well, I want to get into some specific questions, and we're not going to go into much depth about driving safety or fall prevention, because each of these would take a whole show in and of itself. And actually, next week, the show will be dedicated to balance and fall prevention issues. But with winter just around the corner, what can be done to stay safe and cozy during Buffalo's most famous season? And we could start with Patty Ann.
I think one of the most important things that people can do is to make sure that they have carbon monoxide detectors installed in their home. Make sure that they're functioning properly. Make sure that you know how to use them, where they should be installed. And if people have questions about that, they can call their local fire department. It's not an emergency number, and they'll be able to assist you in the placement of those.
Now, why carbon monoxide?
Carbon monoxide detectors are important because whenever you burn any fuel, carbon monoxide is a colorless and odorless, potentially deadly gas that you're completely unaware that it's there, except by your detector.
So it's not like gas from your stove that if it's on, you smell it.
You smell it because the gas that comes from your stove, they actually put that smell into your stove so that you can detect that odor.
So carbon monoxide, I know the greatest concentration is from a furnace. And I believe if your furnace block is cracked, then the carbon monoxide can leak out. And that would also behoove people to get their furnace checked for safety.
That's correct. We suggest that you have a professional come and look at your chimney, not only for carbon monoxide, but for fire safety reasons. Check out your heating systems. And there are other things that people can do. Be sure not to use your oven as a heating source during the winter, as many people do sometimes when the cost of heating fuel is too much. People sometimes use that instead.
So the oven also can put out carbon monoxide?
If your home is blocked, as we sort of all do in the winter, you put plastic on the windows, you put up extra insulation in your house, you don't let the air come in and circulate out. So you want to make sure that you don't do that. Yeah, any heating fuel that you burn produces that.
Now, let's just get back to the carbon monoxide detector. Where should these be placed, and where can you get them, and what's the approximate cost?
You can get them anywhere from, like, Home Depot to Walmart. And I don't mean that to be an advertisement for anywhere, but generally any.
They're widely available.
They're very widely available, and they cost around $30. To put in. You can watch for them to be on sale in the coming months. And you should not put them directly near your furnace, because then it would obviously go off all of the time. But I think if you're a senior, you need to be able to put it where you can hear it and to make sure that you can hear it. So they're very easy to use. You just go and buy one, and you open the box, and they will tell you where in your home, there'll be diagrams depending on what type of furnace that you have, where you should put your detector. And usually most of them work by just plugging them into a socket, pushing a test button. It's as simple as that.
And you don't want to put it on a socket, obviously, that has a switch that you can turn off.
It
wouldn't be on a switch where you might have a light attached also.
Right, and if you've lost some of your hearing or if it's diminished to the point where you're not sure that you can hear that, make sure that you have one closer to where you are so that you can hear it. They don't make visual signals on them yet, like some smoke detectors. You can have a flashing light for people who are hearing impaired. They don't make that on carbon monoxide detectors yet.
Okay, so carbon monoxide detector is a must, as is a smoke alarm in a household. Now, what else for the winter? And let's talk right around the house and things you can do right around the house.
Some of the things you want to do is you want to make sure that you don't completely close in your house so that you have that airflow coming in through there. You need to take care if you use a wood stove, again, that your chimney has been checked, that you know how to properly use it. Make sure that all your flues are cleaned. Make sure that your stove vent, the vent above your stove, has been cleaned, because that can pull odors out and gases out and also provide some fresh air for you.
How often should a chimney be checked and a vent on a stove be checked? Is it your routine preventive maintenance schedule that you recommend?
It is. Yearly.
Yearly. Okay.
Yearly.
Every year.
And make sure that if you use a fireplace or a wood stove that you're using hardwoods that burn clearly. Sometimes people use things like old railroad ties, old wood from the backyard that has paint on it, which causes all kinds of other problems and buildup.
And what about the logs that you get that light very easily? I forget what they're called. That burn completely, I think the main of wax and different substances like that.
Compressed wood chips and
right,
wax.
Are those safe to use?
As long as you follow the instructions and your chimney is clear, that's fine. Sometimes it helps if you put a thermometer on your stovepipe to watch for what the temperature is in there so that you don't do that. Make sure that you have a spark arrestor screen up on your chimney so that sparks don't come out on your roof.
And set your roof on fire. Right. And you probably wouldn't notice that was going until things were fairly far along.
Fairly far along, right. Unfortunately.
All right. Now, around the house, we have sidewalks, and things get pretty slippery during the winter. I know I keep a plastic bucket filled with the salt pellets right on my front porch with a little Chinese restaurant pipe container to scoop it up and spread it around. What do you recommend along those lines? And Kitty, you know, chime in whenever you want to also.
Having an ice melter is important, and sometimes people won't use it because they don't like the damage it does to the concrete. They don't like what it does when you track it into the house. So if you use a potassium-based ice melter, then it doesn't get the damage so that you can get a nice, clear sidewalk and still not have to worry about damage to the grass or the garden.
Or the cuffs of dress pants that...
your shoes, your suede
that
shoes.
Dry cleaners have a tough time getting it out.
One of the other things to do is to make sure that you remove all snow before it packs down and turns to ice. And in Buffalo, as we know, it can be 40 degrees one day and 10 below 2 days later. So you want to make sure that you clear off all that accumulation so that it doesn't pack down and turn to ice or refreeze.
And try to clear a driveway before you drive the car over it, because that just presses the snow down to create that ice layer.
And if you're in a position where you can't remove it yourself, hire somebody to remove it for you, because we don't want people out shoveling and having heart attacks also. Mm-hmm. So you want to be careful.
And what about driveways versus sidewalks? And what's the benefit to clearing a sidewalk instead of just your driveway so you can get out to the street? And I'm talking about the sidewalks also in front of the house and not just from the driveway to your front door.
There's a couple of reasons to keep the sidewalk clear. Number one, in some communities, that's a must. And if you
well,
don't
we know
clear
the town of Amherst, you can get
fire.
Ticketed because mm-hmm. of the tragedy that mm-hmm. happened a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Number two, it helps if, God forbid, you ever need any emergency rescuers. I remember times trying to get a gurney up and over snowbanks and across the lawn because the driveway wasn't clear and the sidewalk wasn't clear. So you really want to keep that clear for emergency responders. And if everybody kept their sidewalk clear, then nobody would be forced to walk along the street, and then we can avoid tragedies like we had on Niagara Falls Boulevard last year.
Where the young kids got hit because they couldn't walk on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
It also keeps youngsters in a job during the winter, clearing sidewalks,
you
so you're stimulating the economy as well when you keep your sidewalk clear.
Well, to that point, I was just going to add that it's probably a good idea as you think about those long, drawn-out months is to kind of get to know who your neighbors are. You know, it might not be a bad idea to just once in a while check in. And kids can do that too, you know, just and maybe help each other out a little bit. You know, sometimes a community effort, sort of a concerted effort, just sort of helps move things along a little bit.
That's a good point, where you have someone that can check periodically if they haven't heard from you or seen you in a day or a certain number of hours, they know to see what's going on at your house. Do you recommend also that maybe people call to check in on a daily basis with friends or relatives, kind of as a sign that everything's okay?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that also helps get rid of the boredom from the
long winter. You're absolutely right, yeah.
Yeah, we know it tends to be kind of depressing in the long winter. People kind of hibernate, and you don't sometimes you hardly see anyone until spring breaks. And then, you know, Lifeline system, certainly as you're clearing walks, if you're doing it yourself, if you happen to be on the back porch bringing some garbage out, then take a fall and you can be back there behind a bush and no one can see you. So that's where something like Lifeline could come in. And also just making people aware that you're there and to check in on you.
Mm-hmm.
What about walking on slippery surfaces? Any specific tips? You know, we'll talk more fully about the whole fall prevention issue and balance, but what about specifically walking on slippery sidewalks with dress shoes versus sneakers versus high heels, perhaps?
Well, I think at any age, the high heels have got to go.
I agree.
It doesn't matter if you're...
It's bad for your back.
It doesn't matter if you're 25 or 75. The heels just don't cut it.
I agree.
On the ice. I did a little experiment last week on the ice at the Twin Rinks with some research I'd been doing to make sure that the tips we were going to give today on how to walk on ice truly worked. And I did take my dress shoes. I didn't take my high heels because I don't walk very well in those on a regular floor. I took a pair of my aunt, who's 78, her overboots, and some sneakers, and tried to walk across the ice rink to see which one gave us the best traction and how to balance walking across the ice. And it was fairly interesting. The first thing I instinctively tried to do was to take tiny, little bitty steps on my tiptoes. And what I learned was, when you walk on your tiptoes, all it does is help you fall forward a little faster. You have to make sure that you're flat-footed. And I think we all do that, because we've been taught, when your mom whacks the floor, you know, you walk tiptoe across it, so you don't want to mess it up.
But you want that surface area to provide as much traction as possible.
Absolutely.
Right?
And you have to make sure that the shoes or the boots or your overboots that you're wearing don't have a smooth bottom. Make sure they have some sort of ripple on them, some good lugs for traction. Just like you put snow tires on your car, you've got to make sure that you have snow tires on your feet, sort of snow boots for your feet, if you will. You have to walk consciously. You have to look ahead of where you're walking rather than not paying attention to a million other things that are distracting you at that time.
Or even looking right down at your feet.
Yeah.
Then you don't see what's coming up in front of you at that moment. I also learned that your hands help balance you. And I tried to walk across with my hands in my pockets, and I fell. Your hands really help make that difference balancing. So I would encourage everybody to keep your hands out of your pockets and be very careful when you're carrying something like groceries or that bag of salt, whatever. Make sure that you can you can walk safely and that you're totally balanced on that.
Well, that's like the tightrope walker that has the big pole that he holds across, he or she holds across to help balance on the tightrope. Same kind of principle, keeping your arms out. Doesn't mean you have to keep them straight out to the side, but it helps distribute your center of gravity a little better.
I found that if you curled your toes a little bit into the bottom of the shoe, that sort of also helped. I don't know why, but it seemed to help a little bit when we went across.
So what was the bottom line? What kind of shoes worked best, and what was the technique that worked best, besides curling the toes and looking a little forward, hands out?
All of my dress shoes failed the test, whether they were flat or whether they were heels, because they all had a nice smooth, they had a nice smooth bottom.
The smooth surface has to go.
It just didn't work. Sneakers provided a little bit more grip, but not a whole lot, because you tend to wear your sneakers all year round, so it wears them out on the bottom, and you get flat patches on there. What worked best were a pair of winter boots that I had that had that nice lug sole on it, taking small shuffling steps, flat-footed, with my arms by my side, worked the best.
Now, where can you get shoes that would be best for the winter? Is there a store that advertises that has a particular brand that works well? Most people get L.L. Bean catalogs and Walmart and Target and all the different stores, Payless shoe stores. What should someone ask for when they go into those places?
I think you just need to pick up the boot and look at the bottom of it. Make sure it doesn't have a heel, because some of the boots are like fashion boots.
Sure.
And they have a heel on them, and make sure that they keep your feet warm, because you don't want to get frostbite out there, because it's a nice looking dress thing. You want to make sure that you can wear it. And again, pick it up, look at the bottom of it, make sure it has a good lug sole that you get good traction. I guess I'd say just again make that comparison to: is this a snow tire for the bottom of my feet, or is this a summer shoe for the bottom of my feet?
And what about specific holidays? Upcoming, we have Thanksgiving. I'm not sure of any particular safety dangers besides overeating tremendously on Thanksgiving. And then we have Hanukkah, Christmas, and a whole variety of holidays throughout the winter. Any specifics you can say about those holidays?
I know for us at Lifeline, we find an increase in the number of people who call and ask about the service. And I think that probably has something to do with the fact that you tend to think of people as getting together a little bit more during that time. And we often say to family members, if you haven't seen mom or dad or grandma in a while, take a look around, see how things are going in the home, see what the needs might be, so that you're a little bit more in tune. And if there is some kind of service that might be needed, I guess I was thinking like a Meals on Wheels or something of that nature. It tends to put people a little bit more in touch, so they're a little bit more aware.
To come by and help maybe with a shower or a bath or help clean the house periodically. That's right. So you do see that. And let me just ask you about Lifeline. Does Lifeline allow for someone to have a family member notified if the alarm goes off? How does that work?
Well, that's actually the first thing that happens. When you need help, you press your button, and that is how you activate your system. But the first thing that happens is a monitor at Lifeline picks up your signal and calls you back. Now, if you need help, you're probably not going to be next to the phone. You may not even be in the same room. Inside of the box, the communicator that's attached to your phone, there's a very sensitive speakerphone. So the first thing they want to do is talk to you. They want to ask you if you're okay, do you need help? And if you do need help, depending on the nature of the type of help that you need, they may in fact call one of your neighbors. When we sign you up for the service, we're actually taking the names of some people that can serve as a responder for you. We encourage neighbors or friends or relatives, someone that doesn't live too far away, that if we were to call them, they might be able to get there in a few moments. Because it isn't always an emergency. It isn't always that somebody has to be transported to the hospital. Sometimes it's an assistance kind of call. Sometimes people just want to talk. You're always going to hear a friendly voice, and sometimes people just like to check in on a daily basis, sort of keeping them in touch like we were talking about earlier. The idea is that you want to get the appropriate help, and sometimes you just need somebody to come by and help you with something.
Now, just an aside, how does Lifeline respond to someone who likes to talk a lot and is lonely, isolated, and they like to hear the voice on the other end?
They do. And, you know, they're never going to cut you off. They're always going to hear a compassionate voice. You're always going to hear somebody that has a concern about your health and well-being. There is a story that goes around Lifeline about the lady who was always calling to see if she could order a pizza. Well, you know, actually, she had a need. She was hungry. In this particular case, Lifeline contacted one of this individual's responders and said, you know, you might want to connect this person up with maybe a church group or a youth group or somebody that might assist her.
But, or the local pizza place.
Or the local pizza place.
One of the responders.
So that's exactly right. But and we have had instances like that as well at the local level, where sometimes it alerts the Lifeline monitor to a need. So they're going to be contacting somebody to say, gee, you know, had an opportunity to speak with Mary, and, you know, she seems a little down, you know, maybe you could stop over. And sometimes that person has the ability to put them in touch with maybe an agency. You know, I think about some of the telephone assurance programs where there are actually volunteers who will call people daily or weekly just to, you know, just for those people that want to talk.
And I'm sure many of the people have a degree of dementia, be it Alzheimer's
sure.
mm-hmm. or something else, and may not know exactly how to do things in their own home. And Lifeline might be the only thing they're able to remember
You're
and
correct.
Know they'll get a voice.
Yes.
They might not be able to dial on a regular phone.
And that is a very much a concern. You want to be able to make sure, for as long as that person wants to remain in their home or can remain in their home, this might be an opportunity for them to do that with some other services.
Just roughly, how much does it cost? Is it a monthly basis?
Mm-hmm.
And an installation fee, so everyone knows what's involved?
Well, it is a monthly charge, and it is mostly a privately paid for service. At present, there aren't insurance companies that cover the cost, although we certainly have lots of family members who do that kind of thing for their loved one. The monthly charge is $39. That covers the cost of renting the equipment and servicing the equipment. And it also gives you that monitoring service 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So no matter what day it is or what time it is, there's always somebody that's going to answer your call. I always stress that monthly fee as well, because you don't sign on for 10 years at a time. You use it month to month. So you're using it for as long as you need it or you want it or until your circumstances change.
And you could stop at
any time. And normally there is an installation charge. Normally that's $50. We are presently waiving that fee. We do promotions from time to time. It is mostly for awareness. We like people to be motivated. And it does give you the opportunity to try it and see if it's the service that makes a difference in your life.
Yeah, I got a fax not too long ago, and it had several coupons. Free Lifeline
sure.
activation coupons. So.
Oh, I'm glad you read your faxes.
They found me, too. Let's take a short break, and we'll be right back, and we'll talk about a lot of other important issues about safety for seniors.
That long ago, men were men and women were gold, always pure as fallen snow. God would save us, that's all we had to know. Now that's all gone away. So we blame it on the passing of the day. Once we were safe and secure, now it seems nobody's sure. times were when we knew the villains wore red and the heroes wore blue. Wrong was wrong and right was right. The good guys always won in the heat of the fight. Now that's all disappeared, and so we live with all that we once feared. Once we were safe and secure, now it seems nobody's sure. When we were young, we met every challenge, each and every one. We stood tall and we stood strong. The whole world gathered around and sang our nation's song. Now that's all done and said, and so we look behind for all we had ahead. Once we were safe and secure, now it seems nobody's sure. Once we were safe and secure, now it seems nobody's sure.
We're back now. This is Dr. Rob Stahl, and I have my guests here on Safety for Seniors, Patty Ann Gazinski, a volunteer with the Erie County Department of Emergency Services, and Kitty Sullivan with Lifeline Systems. We covered a lot of good information in the first half of the show, and I want to remind everyone that we're here also to take your calls, and the phone number here at the studio, 855-6848. I want to make everyone aware that there are different kinds of home safety assessment forms available on the web, and I would also be happy to send a paper copy to anyone who's interested. This is something I've sent out to my patients even before they come into the office, both educational and also to identify potential problems. You can call me at 636-7531 and leave a message about what you want and with your name and address, or you can email me at drstall@whatshouldyouexpect.com. This home safety assessment form is 2 pages long, and we're going to go through that in just a minute. I'll also put a link on the radio show website for the home safety assessment forms if you want to get it through that route. And the website of the show is whatshouldyouexpect.com. Very simply, whatshouldyouexpect.com. Now, we're going to go through this home safety checklist, and it's divided into several areas of safety issues around the house. Housekeeping, floors, bathroom, traffic lanes, lighting, stairways, ladders and step stools, outdoor areas, footwear, and personal precautions. And each section has anywhere from 3 to 14 different questions, all to be answered yes, no. And if you answer no to these, those are action points. Those are things that you should work on to improve the safety in your house. For example, in housekeeping, do you clean up spills as soon as they occur, especially spills, obviously, on the floor? Do you keep floors and stairways clean and free of clutter? Do you put away books, magazines, sewing supplies, and other objects as soon as you're through with them and never leave them on floors or stairways? And And Kitty's shaking her head no to that one.
I got to work on that. I'm going to...
You see, you're helping Kitty, too. Oh,
thank you.
Do you store frequently used items on shelves that are within easy reach, and so you can reach them and not have to go high up, maybe use a step stool or have to stand on the top step of a step stool, which, as we know, could be... somewhat dangerous. And then it goes on to floors do all small rugs have non-skid backings? You don't want to go flying like Aladdin on your throw rugs in your house. Bathroom, do you have a non-skid rug on the bathroom floor? Do you keep soap in an easy-to-reach receptacle? Or are you standing in the shower and reaching awkwardly to grab the soap or shampoo, and that could predispose you to an accident? Do you have grab bars in there if you need them? Or do you have grab bars? And I'd recommend that really for anyone to have grab bars. It can get pretty slippery in a shower or bath. Traffic lanes, we talked about clutter and that type of things. Are telephone and appliance cords kept away from areas where people walk? With all the different devices we use nowadays, that would include computer cords and TV and DVDs and everything else you can imagine. Lighting, do you have light switches near every doorway? Do you have enough good lighting to eliminate shadowy areas? And especially at night, do you have good night lights to get you from bed to the bathroom? Are all the stairways well lighted? Stairways, do they have secure handrails? Are they in good condition? Is the carpeting and metal edges secured well? And on from there. So what do you think about these things? And from your experience, Patty Ann or Kitty, can you add to some of these home safety tips?
I have a couple on housekeeping. One of the most important things to do is to not mix chemicals when you house clean. People tend to do that all the time. They'll mix bleach and ammonia or bleach with something else because they want their toilet bowl absolutely sparkling.
Wow. And
you have to be careful that you don't do that.
And you get the explosion like kids do in chemistry class or
noxious
fumes. That's right. And those fumes can make you go unconscious or make you sick. It can burn your lungs even.
Mm-hmm. For reaching, you said the step stool. You don't have to be senior to worry about that. I'm 5'2" and I can't reach anything in any of my cupboards. So a reaching tool is another good thing.
Excellent
to
idea.
Use that you can buy that are relatively inexpensive so that you don't have to go on that step stool if you're not feeling very comfortable on it.
And here's a simple tip. When using a ladder or a step stool, do you face the steps and keep your body between the side rails? You know, oftentimes, because of logistics, we might place that step stool or ladder kind of sideways and then awkwardly go up there and reach over with our body. So you have to position your ladder or step stool properly. Outdoor areas... do you sprinkle icy outdoor areas with de-icers? We talked about that. Do you have mats at doorways for people to wipe their feet on? Just wiping your feet so you don't bring the wet and ice into the house might prevent a slippery floor inside the house. Get into the footwear again, and then personal precautions. Here's an interesting one. If young grandchildren visit, are you alert for children playing on the floor and toys left in your path? And that also behooves the kids to be taught that, you know, when grandma or grandpa's at the house, you know, you can't leave everything all over the place because it might let them have an accident. Do you always move deliberately and avoid rushing to answer the phone or doorbell? The tendency might be to get up and run before you miss someone and... I would say, you know, better to miss the call, let the answering machine pick up, and then to try and rush and possibly have an accident.
I would like to make a comment on that as well, is that one of the features of Lifeline that most people seem to really enjoy and really pick up on quickly is that you can actually answer your telephone with your Lifeline button. So instead of, as you said, rushing to get to the phone, or people don't let the phone ring as long as you'd like them to, and if you have some of these issues like cords or you're on oxygen or something of that nature, it might be hard for you to get to the phone, and unfortunately you might hurt yourself.
Or if you use a walker or a cane or a wheelchair.
Sometimes it's just enough, you press your button and you actually speak to your incoming caller through the speakerphone.
So that's like activating a speakerphone without having to go right to the phone.
And sometimes it's just enough to say, you know, I can't come to the phone now, or just give me a minute, it'll take me a few minutes longer. And I think that's sort of a peace of mind thing for family members to say, gee, I called 10 times, nobody answered the phone, and that worry and concern.
That's a great feature. Now, here's something I think is important that probably very few people know about unless you're a skier. Do you know how to reduce injury in case you fall? Patty Ann, what can you say about that?
I think it's very important to learn how to fall.
Can you describe it over the radio?
I can try.
Okay.
I can try. You can actually practice learning to fall by sitting down on the floor with your legs flat out in front of you and start to go back and see what your body is doing. One of the things that you don't want to do is when you fall, put your hands out in front of you, because then you break a wrist, you break an elbow, and you hit. If you can remember when it happens and try to fall on a side, sometimes that's... You know, it's hard. Do I hit my head or do I break a hip? Which is
that's right.
Which
what
is,
about
which is which
or
is
break
worse
a hand?
You,
which is worse, breaking
hand,
a hand
worse.
Or a hip? But is there a way to, you know, safely? Do you come down on your rear end? Is there a way to do that?
You try to make yourself as small as possible when you fall. Try to protect your head.
So like a fetal position.
Sort of like a fetal position when you go down.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll have to do a video of you doing this and put that up on the website.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm very good at falling.
Great idea.
Very good at falling.
I don't want you to hurt yourself. And that's why studies can't be done as far as what's the most effective way to fall safely, mm-hmm. because you don't want people to hurt themselves in trying.
And it is a matter of deciding when you go down, which is worse, do I break my hip? Do I break my hand? Do I hit my head?
Vote for older people certainly would be to avoid breaking a hip.
That I was going to say, from my nursing perspective, breaking your hip can be a very dangerous thing, because then it involves a hospital stay and it entails all kinds of other
things. It's a high chance of complication. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I'd love to address on your checklist was under personal precautions number 12, and it says if you wear glasses, is your prescription up to date?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very important, and I never really thought about that till I had my bifocals for the very first time. In a previous job, I used to do fire drills at a lot of adult homes, mm-hmm. and twice a year we would have to have an evacuation drill. And for living in an assisted living facility, you have to be able to self-evacuate to an area of safety. And I watched seniors hesitate on the stairs, and I could never figure out why they hesitated on the stairs, even with help, until I got my bifocals and looked down at a stairway from the first time with my bifocals on. It was very difficult for me to differentiate one stair from another. So if you have stairs at home, if you can sort of forget about decor for a moment and perhaps have the carpeting on stairways a different color or a different pattern, or put paint a strip
along each edge,
that you're not going to trip on, so that you know where the stair begins, because carpeting tends to blend.
Especially if it's dark, and if you're going down at night, or if the hallway's not lit.
Yeah, same thing with escalators. I can't tell you how many times I tripped on the escalators with my bifocals for the first time.
Well, that's another personal say. Escalators, mm-hmm. getting around a department store.
Yeah.
I guess the recommendation, if you feel uncomfortable using an escalator, don't use it.
Don't use it. Take the elevator.
Take the elevator. Right. So, once again, I think this home safety checklist is very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
We identified some things. I think Kitty's going to go home and
clean up.
I wasn't going to say that. But,
you're too kind.
And Patty Ann, she's going to do our video on how to fall safely as a follow-up to this. But once again, I'd be happy to send anyone who calls. You can leave a message at my home office number, 636-7531, or email me, drstall at whatshouldyouexpect.com, and I'd be happy to send this out to you. Now, let's go through some statistics, and this is leading into fire safety issues. More than 1,200 Americans aged 65 and older die as a result of fires each year. Older adults comprise 25% of all fire deaths, and older adults in this country comprise only about 12% of the population, and they comprise 30% of fire deaths that occur in the home. Approximately 3,000 older adults are injured during residential fires each year. Fires and burns are a leading cause of deaths from unintentional injuries among older adults. Cooking fires are the leading cause of injuries due to fires. Older adults living alone have a 30% or greater risk of unintentional injury, and approximately two-thirds of burn injuries to the elderly occur when the victim is sleeping or trying to escape a fire. So, Patty Ann, having been a firefighter involved with emergency services, how can you follow up these facts, and what can people do about it?
I think the first thing that people need to realize is that, and not many of us like to admit this. I certainly don't like to admit this at my age. But, you know, as we age, our mobility decreases, our reflexes slow down a little bit, our hearing and sight may not be as acute as they were. And all of those things come together sometimes and can hamper your escape from it. So you need to be prepared ahead of time. Depending on your physical limitations is going to depend on how you react in a fire. I think the most important thing that people need to know, and people forget all of the time, is that if your house is on fire, you don't call 911 from inside the burning building. You get yourself out first and call from somewhere else, because you're going to lose the time. And if you have some mobility limitations, those seconds become even more crucial to you. Cooking fires happen a lot for seniors. Most people aren't aware of the fact that your pajamas that you wear as an adult have absolutely no flame retardant on them. They're not subject to the fire retardant standards that young children's pajamas are. So if you look at all of our pajamas when you go home, they're extremely flammable. And how many of us get up in the morning, go to make a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, and we've got our bathrobe on with that nice floppy sleeve, and you reach over the stove to make it. And if you have a gas stove, you're a little more aware because you can see the flame. But if you have an electric stove, you're not aware of it so much because you can't see the flame, or you've turned it off and you don't realize that it's still hot.
Do you have a sense which type of stove is safer?
No. I think that any stove can be potentially dangerous.
Okay.
If you're going to use appliances, I can tell you that appliances that turn themselves off are more fire safe. If you're ironing, personally, when I get to be a senior, I intend to do absolutely no ironing. I will have put in my time, and hopefully I can hire somebody to iron for me. But there are irons that turn themselves off if they get left on too long or accidentally knocked over. And tea kettles are another good thing to have, that
tea kettles
that when the water boils out, they turn themselves off. I can't tell you how many tea kettles I've personally ruined, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, having been a firefighter. You turn the tea kettle on, the telephone rings,
you get involved in a book. Watching the World Series or something like that.
Absolutely. And forget about it.
And all of a sudden the smoke detector's going off, and it's like, oh, it's the tea kettle.
Right. So where can you get appliances like this?
Again, any store, just read the label and make sure that it says automatic turn-off switch on it. And any appliance you buy, you want to make sure it has the UL in the circle, the Underwriters Laboratory, to meet those safety standards.
And what about if someone is in a fire? What's the best way to get out of that?
Two things to know. If you're cooking at the stove, or any time that your clothing catches on fire, the first thing you need to remember is stop, drop, and roll. Don't run. Don't try to get yourself to the sink to turn the water on. Don't try to run to the shower to put it out. You drop yourself to the ground. You stop running. You drop yourself to the ground, and you roll. And you don't want to flop on the floor like a fish, because that's not going to do it. You actually want to roll one way. If you come to a wall, then you roll back the other way. if your sleeves are on fire, once you're down on the floor, keep your hands down by your side and roll so that you don't bring the fire up to your face, because you want to protect your airway and your breathing ability. If it's your lower body that's on fire, once you're on the ground, cover your face.
You're trying to suffocate the fire.
Right. Mm-hmm. You
take the oxygen away from it, and then it will stop.
I think another important thing to know is sometimes people try to put the fire out instead of just getting out and call the fire department, because mm-hmm. they're embarrassed, or they don't want their family to know because they're afraid that their family will put them in a home or take away their freedom and their, you know, give them some limitations. I think that people just need to know mistakes happen. Get out. Close the door behind you. If you live in an apartment building, pull the nearest fire alarm and get yourself to safety.
So if you have a fire extinguisher, do you spend the time trying to use that to put out the fire, or do you just get out and let the fire department take care of things? What's the safest thing to do?
There are two schools of thought on that. I think it's great for everybody to have one. I think it's great for everybody to learn how to use one. But I think that it's more important to get out. Nothing you own is worth your life, or no possession is worth it. I think that particularly if your mobility is limited, you need to get yourself out. And hopefully you've planned that ahead of time. Hopefully you have a pre-plan. You've done things like, if you're in a wheelchair, use a walker that they can fit through the exits.
Mm-hmm.
We encourage people to get rid of the stuff in their house. I remember when my parents passed away, there must have been every paper bag that my mother had for 30 years. And I can appreciate that, because my mom and dad lived through a depression, and they certainly know what it was like to do without.
Mm-hmm.
And my generation is very blessed and spoiled, and we have everything, and we're sort of a disposable society. But those things can be a real fire hazard.
Mm-hmm. In the few minutes we have left, let's just touch on accidental poisoning.
Mm.
When does it typically happen, and what could be done about it?
The biggest type of accidental poisoning for seniors comes from their medications. Make sure that you can read your medication labels clearly. Always double check it before you use it. Make sure it's the right one. Make sure that you don't be tempted if one works, maybe two will be better. Make sure you know what medicines can be mixed with each other. Make sure you know which ones can be mixed with over-the-counter medicines. Make sure you tell your healthcare providers all of the over-counter medicines that you're taking. Sometimes people think that, well, because it's herbal or over-the-counter, it must be safe, so I can take it with my medicines, but that's not necessarily.
And we talked about that a few months ago on medication use and abuse, and it happens all the time. And I think a special warning, like you said, for over-the-counters and herbals. Many of the cold medications, sleeping pills, mm-hmm. the over-the-counters can really throw older people for a loop. Cold medications are basically... are often a witch's brew of all the different things that can control symptoms, but they don't really kill the cold. The cold's a virus that there's no effective antibiotic for. So you're trying to reduce the symptoms, and in reducing the symptoms, you get the side effects of those medications as well. Any other poisoning areas? You mentioned mixing household chemicals.
And throw out old household chemicals. Sometimes you find something that worked really, really good. For example, laundry bluing, is a favorite of everybody, and it's very difficult to find, so people sort of ration it, and they have this 20-year-old bottle of laundry bluing. Some chemicals aren't stable over a long period of time, and they might have been safe when they were first new, but they may not be now, and it might be too late to know that. So, actually, if people want to get in touch with you through the website, and I can send to you some alternatives, some natural alternatives, for example, for drain cleaner. There are times, I guess, when you need, like, liquid plumber or Drano.
And that's extremely toxic.
It is. And if ever
my kids almost blew up the toilet bowl, I think, mixing something with that.
At my house, I just use baking soda and vinegar once a week down my drains, followed by a hot water flush. And that tends to keep them clear, and it's a nice natural alternative for those sorts of chemicals. And I think the other thing that happens is, as you get older, your sense of smell diminishes
mm-hmm.
a little bit. So those of us who might back off from those fumes, if your sense of smell is diminished, you might be leaning right over that drain cleaner and you're inhaling those fumes, right. And it gets dangerous.
And you may not even notice it.
Mm-hmm.
I know, part of the clogs in toilets, I had to deal with this in a toilet that didn't seem to be functioning well. And I called the manufacturer, and they gave very interesting tips. Make sure the water in the tank is where it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure the chain connecting the handle to the flapper is tight. And then there are these little holes around the rim of the toilet that can get clogged up, that can decrease the flow. And by checking all of those things, we now don't have much of a problem in that particular toilet. So, well, we're going to have to start wrapping up. It's all the time we have today, and I thank you so much, Patty Ann and Kitty. Great show, a lot of great information, and I'm sure that the information that you shared today will help someone and
mm-hmm.
maybe prevent a real tragedy. Starting next Monday, the show will be on monthly instead of weekly, the first Monday of every month. Next week, the first Monday of November, we'll continue our safety discussion talking about balance and fall prevention. My guest will be Fred Portum, a doctor of physical therapy with WellCare and an expert and innovator in approaches to preventing falls. This is Dr. Rob Stahl. See you next week.